Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening, liking, subscribing, sharing, and giving those 5-star reviews on whatever podcast platform you listen to. Those really mean a lot in getting the word out about the podcast, and they keep us motivated to continue going out and finding those dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories for you guys to stay entertained and learn something from. So if you guys keep it up, we'll keep it up. I promise you that. As promised, today we've got part two of our interview with Peter Ident, former lieutenant and survivor of the Coast Guard cutter Cuyahoga tragedy. If you haven't listened to part one, I encourage you to go back and listen to it before you do this one. Hugely impactful story, and he really talks about one of those incidents that serves as a catalyst for why things are done the way that they are now in the Coast Guard. So if you haven't listened to it, do so. Share it with friends. A lot of stuff to take home from it. And with that, here's part two.
Now is talk a little bit about a few of my classmates.
Okay.
Every year I go to the Coast Guard Memorial Service and speak. And the thing that I noticed that it was, you know, brass and steering wheels and bells. And it wasn't about the people. And to me, very much so, it's about the people. And what I wanted to do today was just tell you about four of my shipmates that died that day. One of the things that I did do too for the memorial was I hired an artist to draw large portraits of each one of them. So when the officer candidates walk by, they can see the people that actually, at least four of the people that actually died. And I'd like to start with John Heisted. His older brother was in the Coast Guard and was a lieutenant commander in the reserves. John's goal from a very early age was to follow his brother through OCS. John was an expert in Coast Guard history and impossible to dislike. Although he had some problems drilling. At one point, he was drilling and his M1 rifle came flying out of his arms, somersaulting towards Lieutenant Emery, who was an ex-Army drill sergeant.
He never said, good.
Never a good day.
He sent him back to the ordnance shop to get Big Bertha. And for the rest, Big Bertha was a M1 that was about four times the size of a normal rifle. It was
awesome. I love that they had one of those just stowed away somewhere. That's great.
So that's a motivational tool.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So he had to march in the two colors, with his rifle being extra big, and he had such a baby face. It was he looked like a toy, a boy carrying a rifle. It was really funny. I remember Captain Blaha and Commander Loy, who later became commandant, they just started laughing out loud. It was really hilarious. And you're absolutely right. He didn't drop his rifle ever again.
Oh, sure. Right. Yeah.
So I like talked a little bit about James Clark. He was my current roommate. He was an only child from Arizona. His parents had run a number of laundromats, and Jim was an excellent adjuster. And he just wanted more out of life, so he got accepted to OCS. Jim was the kind of guy that got things right the first time and then was absolutely a born leader. It was great to be his roommate. He really helped me out a lot. Just as you can imagine, like the perfect, if you envision a perfect soldier, that was Jim Clark or Seaman. Then I'd like to talk a little bit about Ed Thomason, who was a Marine engineer and knew his future was below decks. After his watch, he went down into the engine room to see if he could help and learn more. He was down there. He was my confidant. I remember saying to him once, I'm not sure if I'm ready for this. And he said, you were born ready. And I find it amazing that, you know, he could have, after his watch, gone in and taken a nap. We hadn't taken a nap in 6 weeks, but instead he went right into the engine room, started working. And he was right about where the ship hit, and it flew him across, and hopefully he died instantly. I'm just going back to Jim Clark again, and I'm James Clark. His body was found by the divers, and he was in berthing. And only one person made it out of berthing. And he, when they opened the emergency hatch door, he was the first one that popped out, and it made me really sad. But then I knew one thing. He was doing the right things. He wasn't panicking. He had done about four turns on that emergency hatch and almost had it open. So he fought all the way to the end. Then I'd like to talk a little bit about Bruce Wood. Bruce has been working undercover within the Ghost Guard for a year prior to getting into OCS. The undercover work, which always involves lying and pretending you're somebody else, took a toll on him and his family, and he was finally getting life back into order. And he was getting back with his wife.
Peter, what kind of undercover work did he do? This is a totally has nothing to do with the collision. I'm very curious now. I mean, you can't just drop undercover work in the Coast Guard and then not get a question out of it, I think.
He couldn't talk about it.
Yeah. Doesn't that make you wonder? Do you wonder, like, even to this day, like, there's actually non-rate CGIS agents out there somewhere just trying to fry people? That's good.
You know, this was the 70s, and there were drug problems in the Coast Guard. There's no doubt about it. There were a few times where they went to pick up six bales of marijuana floating in the water, and they turned into the locker four bales. Mm-hmm. So, there was a little bit of corruption. It was a different time. So my daughter, she's right now, along with my wife, just sewing. My daughter runs a small fashion business, and she's got all her employees all working on masks.
Wow, awesome.
And my wife just made 90.
Excellent. Yeah,
so we're all speaking of America coming together.
Right? Yeah, right?
Absolutely. Here we go. Yeah.
Excellent.
So pretty proud. So so the story that she's going to tell is one by Katie Carter. And Katie Carter was the younger brother of First Class Carter, YM1 yeoman. And he was, one of the things that I would say about him is he didn't have to go out on that boat at all. He was a yeoman. He worked regular shift. because the regular crew of the Cuyahoga was down, he donated his weekend to going out with us on the cruise, and he passed away. And his sister wrote to me in a number of letters, and I've incorporated what she said, and I'm going to have my daughter read it and put it in the first person, because she was a marvelous writer, and I changed very little. When you get good writing, you don't change it.
Hey, so now we've got Peter's daughter, Kelly, on the line. Kelly, welcome to the show. Go ahead and read it.
I'll never forget that morning. I was a sophomore in high school. I woke up and realized I had overslept. My alarm clock hadn't gone off, and now I would be late for school. I was a majorette and was supposed to perform with my pep squad in a parade that morning. I went downstairs about to whine to my mom that she hadn't woken me up, but stopped mid-sentence. There was a uniformed Coast Guard officer standing in our living room talking to them. My father was also in the Army, so I knew what that meant. I'd recently lost my grandfather, and my heart sunk when I recognized the look on my mother's face. My mom turned to hug me and said they had some very bad news about my big brother. Bill's ship went down, and he's still missing. I later found out that my parents had been up all night after seeing a report on the 11 o'clock news. My mom had snuck into my room to turn off my alarm clock, hoping they would hear from Bill before I woke up. I couldn't believe this was happening. Bill and I were supposed to work on his Wonder Van the next weekend, a VW microbus he had bought used that he was turning into a camper. Bill's dream was to be a Coast Guard officer. He worked his regular duties and helped the Cuyahoga crew on weekends, earning experience to improve his chances of getting into the OCS. My big brother also acted in our local theater and liked to write comedy. He was always making everyone laugh. He was only 22.
Wow. That really brings it right home.
Let's see. The other thing I wanted to do was to talk about the people that tried to help us. As soon as the Coast Guard cutter went down, we didn't get off of Mayday. However, the Santa Cruz did get off of Mayday. The Coast Guard immediately got on the line, and everybody.
Peter, did you ever get a chance to hear, did they record that Mayday, or did you ever get a chance to get a transcript of the Mayday, you know, what it said or anything? Do you know what it said?
No, I didn't. No. I didn't get a transcript.
I'm just curious because I don't even know how I would report that. You know, I mean, that's got to be a panic moment for all involved because, you know, the Santa Cruz knew what she hit. Yeah, I can't. I'm just curious how that came across.
You know, it's interesting when you said that because, you know, after we got aboard the Santa Cruz, you know, I said, did you feel the collision to one of the Spanish guys? And he goes, no.
No. Wow. Yeah, just too big. Too big, I get, right?
Too big.
Yeah, too big.
But I'd like to thank the Smith Point Sea Rescue Squad. Searchers from the Smith Point Squad. One of them was Dr. Alfred Hunt. A local dentist. He, along with dozens of other pleasure boaters, got a call from the squad's phone at 9:30. Dr. Hunt reported that when boats were launched, the squad was running high on adrenaline. But in the pitch black darkness, they had to slow their hearts and their motors to make sure they didn't run over anyone that was trying to rescue. He and dozens of other boaters were joined by fishing boats, tugboats that all heard the SOS. Most spent the entire night. And most of the morning searching. It wasn't just boaters either. Scores of people who lived along the shore left their homes and searched the beaches all night and into the day. Thank them. Thank
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
I thank them very much. It's very telling how America comes together when there's a tragedy.
Look for the helpers.
Look for the helpers. The Blackhorn happened 15 months after the Cuyahoga. And to give you a little background, it was a 180-foot tugboat, about 40 years old. And it was in the yard in Tampa Bay for 5 months. And it was being finished. It was ready to go. And the crew had flown in from Texas. They were going to go back to Galveston, Texas. And they started out at 6 in the morning, void traffic. Came out, a couple things didn't work. Came back in. They worked on it. They went back out. They came back in. It was 6 o'clock before they reached, before they hit the main part of the channel, or the combat zone, as they called it.
The combat zone. I can attest to, I think it is kind of the combat zone down there. It's pretty difficult to navigate.
It is called the combat zone. Yeah. And it's, you know, a very narrow channel, but the bay is really wide. So right. The only thing you have to go on are buoys mm-hmm. and centerline buoys. And because it was so narrow, the Corps of Engineers had dredged it another 100 feet, added another 100 feet to it. But they hadn't finished the project. But everyone was cheating over by an extra 50 feet because they knew they had 100 feet. Mm-hmm. And, of course, those were pilots that knew exactly where they were going and had, you know, could do it blindfold. And the Blackthorn had never sailed out of Tampa Bay before. None of the crew had ever been out there. And so they were not familiar. And the pilots will come back to you and say, that Coast Guard vessel should have had a pilot on it. But quite frankly, Coast Guard couldn't afford to have a pilot every time they go into a foreign port. Plus, they're more maneuverable ships. So that didn't really make sense. So when they were having trouble with one of the tachometers. And so the captain was occupied with working on that. And the XO was working on another navigation point. And they just hit the dogleg of the combat zone. And the captain, because he was having problems with the tachometer, sort of broke away from the bridge and put OOD Randy Ryan in charge. Randy Ryan was a class ahead of me at OCS. He had just made OOD just a few weeks before they went into port. So he was really out of practice. You know, he didn't have much practice to begin with. The captain was attending to the tachometer. And in the combat zone, there was a kind of rule you let out. No one goes through together. They go one by one. But they were going through, and then all of a sudden, the Kazakhstan, which was a huge cruise vessel, you know, lit, you know, up from, you know, every single, and much, much taller than Blackthorn. So they pulled ahead, and they were going into the, their radar basically didn't work, because all they could see is this big boat in front of them.
Right.
This big ship in front of them. So they had a difficult time seeing. Plus, their equipment was right in the bow. So you had to be 10 degrees to the left or 10 degrees to the right to actually see forward. And the Capricorn, this huge 500-foot oil tanker, was coming in, and it barely missed the Kazakhstan, and the two pilots apologized to each other. But then all of a sudden, steaming.
That's right, never good, though. That's never good when two pilots apologize to each other. Yeah. That's not good.
So when the, you know, they hit the dogleg, before they hit the dogleg, the Ensign Ryan had seen that it was going in a certain direction, but of course, they had to turn about 15 degrees. And they were cheating over, because everybody was cheating over. Of course, the Coast Guard didn't know about this new extra 100 feet because they hadn't changed the charts yet. So, in fact, the Coast Guard was to the right of the center line, and the Capricorn wasn't. And, you know, as soon as the Kazakhstan passed them, The people in the Capricorn were just shocked. What, you know, what the fuck is this guy doing? It literally is what the Capricorn captain said. They're trying to cut in front of us. And so he said, two horns, starboard to starboard passage. For some reason, the Blackthorn didn't hear it. The captain all of a sudden saw the Capricorn come up, and he said, hard left rudder. And they just scraped by each other. Would have been a minor accident, except the Capricorn had its anchor out. Okay, you know, they put their anchor ready in case they had to stop quickly in the harbor. And that anchor launched itself into the shower room of the Blackthorn. And they knew they had, they called everybody's stations. They sent out parties to look at the vessel. And one guy coming out of the shower room says, hey, before you take a shower, you ought to get rid of that anchor out of there. And it didn't seem too hard. They were both going. But as the, I think it's 800 feet of chain reeled out, they came to the bitter end, and it dragged the Blackthorn backwards almost immediately, and water started rushing over the stern. And so both captains of the Capricorn and Captain Staple of the Blackthorn said, beach it. Find the nearest shoal. Let's get on land, because, you know, you certainly don't want to sink in deep water. So when they both started heading towards the shoreline, the anchor started loosening up and actually slid under the Capricorn. And when it slid down, it's 7,000 pounds plus its chain, and then it was now pulling, instead of straight backwards, athwartships. It just immediately capsized the vessel. And, you know, the people that were in station were all in the mess hall. And five of the six people had never been on the ship before. They were right out of basic training. And they saw the water coming. You know, they were suddenly flipped onto the bulkhead, onto the ceiling, and suddenly the water was coming up. And there, you know, unlike Gordon Thomas, he knew how to swim down to get out. They went up into the ship, and all five out of six of them perished. And that's what happens when you don't have a lot of training and experience behind you. You know, all in all, they lost 23 men. When the boat was on its side, William Flores was 18 years old, again, right out of basic and a seaman apprentice. And he got to the life jacket bin. He opened it up. He strapped his belt around the top of the lead to keep it open. He started throwing life jackets. People started saying, get off, because it was on its side. He got off. He immediately went to someone that was in danger who lived, and they never saw Flores. They found Flores floating a few days later. 21 years later, after that, Flores won the Coast Guard Medal, which is the highest medal can be awarded. And just last year, they named a Coast Guard cutter after William Flores. Mm-hmm. So, again, a lot of heroism.
They just built a. I think he was included in the. I know he was included. Coast Guard Chief Petty Officers Association sponsored a statue of him that you can now dive on, with statues cool. of all the other services. Yeah, so very, like a very cool way to remember him. I think if anybody gets the chance to go down there and to remember all the lives that were lost there.
So I just like kind of run down, you know, the error chain that I saw in comparison to the Cuyahoga.
Because there are tons of similarities. Just thinking about, you know, what we talked about on the last episode to now, tons of parallels that I never even realized.
Absolutely. I mean, both ships were old, and both of them couldn't meet their own safety standards. The delay of the Cuyahoga, which changed all the shifts and made us go out at night really without radar. Their delay from malfunctioning equipment. These guys were on edge. They had waited 12 hours to get out of Tampa Bay, and they were, you know, they were all in kind of pissy moods. Mm-hmm. Except for the captain on the Cuyahoga, except for the captain, everybody was brand new. And in the case of the Blackthorn, the team was rusty and the OOD was new. Mm-hmm. Our captain was distracted by training. He was not only trying to pilot through the Chesapeake, but he was also trying to teach us at the same time. The captain of the Blackthorn was distracted by the malfunctioning piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, and both ended up being night piloting. And night's a lot more dangerous to sail at night. I don't like going out at night. I better get in before the sun sets, I'll tell you that. The captain was exhausted in the Cuyahoga, and in the case of the Blackthorn, the whole crew were tired. It was a long day, especially a long day first day back at work. The lookout on the Cuyahoga was brand new, never been out on a ship before. The lookout for the Blackthorn was brand new, never been out on a ship before. Incidentally, he had those sound power phones that, and he almost strangled to death. He had a hard time getting out. So, you know, I put in the Gordon's part of the book that Coast Guard hadn't heard of the new invention by Alexander Graham Bell yet. he made me take that out. But those sound power phones were accidents waiting to happen.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT. Want to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
Basically, we misread the lights. In the case of the Blackthorn, they couldn't see the lights. Mm-hmm. It just came after them right after the Kazakhstan passed them. The Cuyahoga gave really the wrong whistle. We really should have insisted on a port-to-port passage. In the case of the Blackthorn, they didn't hear the Capricorn's whistles. They didn't make both cases. They didn't make radio contact. The XO called out and said we were going to be okay. A ship came back and said we're just coming out of anchorage. We'll be fine. And it turns out they were on 25 watts, and they were 3 miles away talking to another ship. So again, radio communication was. Or in our case, it wasn't done at all. The accident of a dogleg in the middle of the ocean, you have to take a left so you don't ground. How do you know? In the case of the Blackthorn, there were 2 center buoys. One was not properly working. The other one was actually a little off. So Ryan actually had to go look starboard to get his next bearing. So he actually had to take his eyes off what was coming at him and look behind to get a proper bearing. And that's, you know, and we were trying to get a bearing off Smith Point Light when we were all of a sudden. In the case of the captain of the Cuyahoga was confused because of his illness. In the case of the Blackthorn, they didn't have local knowledge. And local knowledge is very important.
Those
pilots have to be blindfolded. I mean, they have to basically draw their channel within feet without any references. Both vessels turned to port, you know, and you learn that in driver's ed.
Yep.
If you think you're
turning
going to collide,
left is always
go to
the wrong
right.
Answers.
Yep. Yeah. That's what we talked about on the
first
on episode one was, yeah, don't never turn to port. You turn to port mm-hmm. and something, things are going to go bad.
Both vessels, neither vessel slowed down. We tried to stop, but when the Santa Cruz didn't understand what we were doing, thought that we were cutting in front of them, it was really, you know, even though we were the burden vessel, it's really their obligation, if they don't understand where we were coming from, to slow down. Mm-hmm. And they didn't slow down at all. So that certainly contributed, you know, if things go, people just kind of slow down. It would have been a lot. And in the case of the Cuyahoga, there was just a lot of bad luck. And the Blackthorn, it was really bad luck. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of another ship getting caught in an anchor and capsizing like that. So just real bad luck. Abandoned ship was not piped. In either case, the power went out as soon as they flipped. There were new people unfamiliar with escape routes, just like there were new people unfamiliar with escape routes on the Blackthorn. Most emergency lights didn't work on the Cuyahoga, and no emergency lights worked on the Blackthorn. In the Cuyahoga, the quarters were so tight that the ladder going out of the berthing area, they built in stairs. I mean, in drawers into each stair. So, you know, you get a couple of drawers to put your crap. But if you can imagine, all those drawers came out.
Mm-hmm.
As my friend Arn Denny was trying to climb out, he's climbing up a ladder that had drawers on its side, you know, and yes. pushing against, you know, hundreds of pounds of water. In the case of the Blackthorn, because a lot of the people stayed in Florida for that 4 or 5 month period, they had a lot of junk. And so they actually just put it up there. There's actually even a small car that was strapped down on the Blackthorn. So egress, you know, and lots of bikes and things. So egress was blocked. Headphones.
Phil,
in
your
both
dogs
cases.
Are excited.
Can you hear them? Yeah, they got a lot. The delivery guys here. I'm sorry, guys. Yeah, that was totally okay, my bad. I am sequestered in a room too, and they're still making noise out there.
Yeah, I sequestered myself upstairs, but it's just
Did you see that? It was very slow. I was like, I was trying. I guess I could have just muted it, but then I got to reach around and figure it out. I'd probably screw something up.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, sir. Yeah,
I know that was terrible. That was my fault.
No, that's okay. So you can edit that back, right?
Yeah, I got it off. Yeah, no problem.
I just got a couple of more. We didn't have survival swimming on the, before we went out. The pool had a crack in it. They drained the pool. So we did not get a chance to have survival swimming before we went out. And many of the people in the Blackthorn didn't have survival swimming. The self-inflating life rafts, hydrostatically released life rafts, didn't work in the Cuyahoga, didn't work in the Blackthorn. You know, the
We never Cuyahoga. Talked about that, Peter, because when you came up off the Cuyahoga, I mean, you guys were on a small boat that wasn't designated as a survival craft. What happened to all the hydrostatically released life rafts? Other than sinking to the bottom, which I'm guessing happened.
Believe it or not, I mean, one of them inflated, but as the boat landed on its side, just stuck underneath the boat.
Okay.
And the one on the other side, the channel was no more than, I think, 35 feet deep, and it wasn't actually deep enough for the hydrostatic life raft to come up.
Wow.
And then in the Blackthorn's case, there was like an individual reason why each one of those rafts didn't work.
That's unbelievable, man. Awful.
It really is. I mean, and I think the final comparison is, I think after the Cuyahoga, they didn't learn from their mistakes. But I think from the Blackthorn, they did learn from their mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to court-martial Sable twice, and twice A board of inquiry turned him down. There was a lot of people to blame. And so I think there's huge parallels. And I think that, Cuyahoga was, well, that's just bad luck and maybe a bad sailing experience. But when the Blackthorn went down, they said there is systemic problems with the Coast Guard. And they really started challenging those and tried to make the Coast Guard a lot safer and more professional. I mean, the Coast Guard had a lot of names in those days, the Wavy Navy. My uncle said when I was joining the Coast Guard, he goes, "Oh, that's good." He goes, "You're tall. In case the boat sinks, you can wade to shore." So, that's kind of
poor joke.
I don't know if you can see joke. Phil's background. He's got a Puddle Pirate sticker right behind him, yeah, actually. Speaking of over 6 feet tall and wading to shore.
And now I would say it's exactly the opposite. We are that hard nucleus about which the Navy forms in times of war. And the people are extremely professional. And as I mentioned before, just look at Katrina. Just Coast Guard is in very good light. And I'll tell you, in any town, I grew up on the Cape and Woods Hole, which is part of Falmouth. And I'll tell you, we had a lot of respect for the Coast Guard then. My dad got pulled back a couple times, attempted rescue a couple of times by the Coast Guard. So we were also afraid of getting fined, too. So,
sure, yeah.
But Coast Guard were a part of a lot of communities up and down the East Coast and West Coast and Alaska, especially.
And Peter, take us through again. I find it inspiring that, you live through this and now you continue to kind of pay forward the lessons learned. Can you talk again about what got you to do that?
I ask myself the question is, okay, I want these memories of these people to live a year, a moment longer. And then I thought to myself, what would these guys want other Coasties to learn? Mm-hmm. And I think I start out by talking about a lot of heroism in the Coast Guard, because I think they would want everyone to know about the heroes in the Coast Guard and the tragedies and the glories of the Coast Guard. So I put a lot of that in my book. And then I wanted them to think about to learn from your mistakes. I think it's just extremely important. And I think, those 11 guys looking down saying, boy, I hope they learned something from this. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do when I do the error chain in the back of every chapter. I kind of dissect all the things that went wrong and see, what can we learn? And anybody reading this book, I think, can learn, something about how things go bad and they go bad and they get worse and worse. And you just got to break that error chain. So I think they would want
to go bad quick, too.
Yeah, very quick. I mean, the Cuyahoga, I was so casual about it because my father always said, it's like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. So I figured at least we'd have time to rearrange some deck chairs. I had no idea we'd go down in 2 minutes. Right. You never see that on TV.
Right.
Of course, they probably draw it out like I draw it out in my book, or I described it. But the quickness that it went down. And none of the compartments had watertight integrity. It had so many reworks, so many, hoses and pipes that had to be repaired, that they never really fixed the compartmental integrity. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why it went down like a rock. I mean, it had a huge hole in it. And it's just every compartment just filled with water almost immediately.
Yeah, Peter, I'll attest, man, to the enduring nature of what you guys went through and of you writing about it, because these are still names that are well known by the entire service.
Absolutely.
So the lessons that came from both of these, the Cuyahoga and the Blackthorn, are people can quote them. I mean, we know what they are. Yeah. So Don't think that those lessons are lost. I hope that gives you some kind of comfort.
It does.
I can definitely say, you know, as you're sitting here telling the story and talking about Blackthorn, thinking of my time on cutters, and like, I remember not sailing because both our radars didn't work and we weren't allowed to sail if both radars didn't work, let alone, you know, having no radar. We still had a functional radar. So hopefully the organization, it sounds like painfully, but has learned the lesson. And it's definitely a lot of stuff that's really hard and fast now that we wouldn't dream of doing, that it sounds like, unfortunately, we had to learn the hard way.
And the other lesson that I tell when I go to OCS and talk to the OCs is that, you know, you're a leader, and if you start cutting corners, everybody else behind you, below you, is going to start cutting corners. You know, you got to follow there's good reasons why they have these rules. I mean, it may only happen, you know, once in 10,000 times, but the Coast Guard goes out every day, and 10,000 times adds up pretty damn quick.
Right.
So, you know, you really have to take these precautions. You know, when we tried on the life jackets the day before the Cuyahoga went out, I noticed there was a line on it. So I kind of opened it up, and it looked like there was a chemistry test inside of it. It was, you know, your flashlight and the battery was rotten. And the guy said, oh, those haven't worked since the Korean War. You know, like, I'll tell you, those things were hard to get into. You know, I just, you know, I figured if I abandoned ship, I'd have like 10 or 15 minutes to get that thing on, because it's not easy to get on one of those big life jackets. When Flores was throwing the life jackets out to people, none of them actually put them on. They just hung on to them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I don't know. Do they make life jackets any easier? Like a May West where you can just pull a...
Yeah, well, I mean, the May Wests are great, but survival suits are still, you know, you have 2 minutes to put them on is kind of the standard time, and you're pushing it at 2 minutes. So as quick as, you know, you guys went down, probably wouldn't have gotten them on anyway, frankly.
Right. Right.
I keep thinking about the guy's joke about the anchor and the Blackthorn. I mean, what a terrible time to make a joke. You know, it brought it back. Like, man, if you guys are going to take a shower, you should surely get that thing out of here. At least that's typical Coast Guard to me, I think.
It is.
Right.
I just love it.
I assume that was a bosun mate who told that joke.
It had to have been. Like it almost had to have been.
Unfortunately, he didn't make it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, he probably said, I got time to put my clothes on.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Well, that whole sequence of events, as you described, I mean, if you wrote that for a movie, somebody would go, no, this is too unbelievable. We're not going to put this in the movie. Nobody will believe this could happen.
Right.
And really, nobody could believe, you know, ocean's big. How do these two ships hit each other? You know, it's remarkable how I remember when I was being driven to Baltimore for the National Transportation Safety Board. You know, I get in the car and I jumped in the front seat with the driver, and he said, "What the hell? What are you? Are you guys all drunk?" I was like, that's probably what people were thinking. Yeah. You know, were you smoking marijuana or something? You know, it really was. I remember, you know, because of the, again, I told you about the story about how, you know, OC makes faithful command. And I went back to Falmouth on Thanksgiving, and I went to the bar that I worked at during the summer, and it was slow. So we went to the other bar and it was filled. And I went up and talked to the bouncer, and he said, Hey, weren't you in the Navy or something and killed a bunch of people?
Oh, man.
It was like...
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, it spoiled my day.
Yeah. Wow. That was brutal.
You never know. Yeah. And, you know, it's... Admiral Neptune, who was in our class and it was on the previous trip, had the assignment of writing the watch quarter bill when everybody would have their shifts. And he blamed himself, you know. He said, but we were supposed to have an anchor watch. But he still, just because he wrote that piece of paper, you know, he said he thought about it. It's like, I want a death warrant to these people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody that was involved, especially when I came back, the officers, you know, two other officers, usually two officers were on board from OCS on board the Cuyahoga at any one time, and almost certainly they were on the bridge the whole time. And since they didn't go, I think every officer in OCS thought, oh God, if I was on that vessel, that wouldn't have happened. That's a tough thing. That's a tough thing to live with, you know, because they could have, you know, they were extremely competent. They were instructors. They were teaching us. And just unfortunately, they weren't on board. And I think there's a lot of people say, well, if I was in that position, I don't think, you know, I think, well, we would have got out of it. But sometimes just bad luck.
We all think that. I think that's anybody, you know, anybody that wasn't there that feels like they could have made a difference. And that's the way the Coast Guard too, right? People just feel like they can make a difference. We all want to respond to the alarm. We all want to be there for it. So I can understand.
And there's a reason that Monday morning quarterback is a term that everybody knows what we mean.
And it's pretty bad in the Coast Guard in general, our Monday morning quarterbacking.
Well, it's also a national instinct to separate yourself from a tragedy. You know, like someone gets coronavirus, but well, I don't fly on a plane, or I don't do this, so that won't happen to me. And I think that is a very, very natural response to deal with tragedies like this, is to separate yourself from it.
Certainly.
I think it kind of goes back, Peter, to you were talking earlier about, you know, something similar with, hold on, I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. I had a note, I lost it. I'll cut it out. Never mind. Lost it. Sorry, guys. The dog is still back there. I've had to hit mute like four times.
Usually I'm the one who can't get out of coherent thought, Phil.
So I know I lost it today. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I know. I stuff. I am. I is. I are.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, we would talk a little bit about our shipmates. Of course, we couldn't talk about the accident, but I can tell you OCS was a lot different, you know, the last two-thirds of it. There was no more, you know, finding lint on people's shirts. It was
life and death.
And part of it was, you know, the investigation went on and on. Wyan one Carter's father was an Army soldier, and he became the official record keeper for the Cuyahoga. And when the Blackthorn went down and they had the hearings for Sapel, he attended everyone because they had him in Yorktown at the training center. And I'd like to thank him, too. He's not alive today, but he gave me a stack of all his copy material that was a foot high. And I made another copy of it, and I put it in the OCS, hoping somebody will just gaze at some of these. Took out the one about OC makes safe command, though.
Right, don't blame you on that one. You know, that one can just burn somewhere. Fair enough. I remember what I was going to say, Peter. The you know, it kind of, you mentioned earlier about the Cuyahoga ceremony just turning into, you know, a ceremony, right? Just pomp and circumstance, and not the human element. I think we can speak to that. And it just makes me appreciate what you're telling us so much more, right? Because you're right. When all of those guys at Yorktown get together and the order comes out, we're going to put this ceremony on this year. And, you know, it's the 4,000th time we've done this ceremony, right? Initially, I think that's what they kind of turn into, is just pomp and circumstance.
Right.
But then you see the survivors, right? You see the grandmother, the children, the grandchildren, all these people that did have loss, right? That suffered it, and that impacts you. And then we get to talk to you about the guys who were actually on the boat, and you being on the boat, and how it felt, and how it looked, and smelled, and everything else. And I, you know, just thank you for bringing that to us, right? Because I can't tell you how critically important it is to hear stories like that.
Absolutely. I mean, it definitely puts a whole new perspective on it. You know, the next time that comes around.
And to even read it in your book, right? Like, to even read it in your book is just reading it. But to see you, to hear you say it, totally just mind-blowing, I guess. I don't know another way to really put it. Very impactful.
At the end of every ceremony, I stand at the and I shake every one of their hands, as they're going out and thanking them for their service. And it's, I just keep thinking of, my friends like Jim Clark and Heisted, and how it's like no time has changed. Those, they're exactly the same. They're gung-ho, clean-cut, just highly dedicated. And it thrills me to see that, to just be involved in that. Now that I'm retired, it's an exciting thing to see people who actually do work and see people.
I don't know if I'd call what we do work, but
some days, yeah, it
depends. Well, it's what you do, and it's not work.
There you go.
Find something you like to do, and you'll never work a day in your life.
It's so true. Well, that's the Coast Guard, man. If they would just let us die doing what we do, I think I'd be pretty happy.
I always tell my wife, I don't know what I'm going to do when I retire from the Coast Guard and have to actually pretend I'm a grown-up.
Yeah, drink a lot. You're going to drink a lot. That's what you're going to do.
I get to be a giant man-child and get paid for it right now, and it's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, any parting shots?
I have a question. How's the museum going?
Excellent.
Coast Guard Museum.
They're constantly getting funding. Have you got your retiree newsletter?
I haven't. No. Okay.
All right. Well, look on page 39.
Don't worry about the rest of it.
Don't worry about the rest. It is page 39. No, we've got an ad in the latest newsletter. But the National Coast Guard Museum Association took over the retiree newsletter and have done just leaps and bounds over what it was before. So I'll shoot you a link to it after this, and we'll post it on the podcast too, so everyone can see. But I think you will be very, very impressed. I really do. I think you're gonna like it. And it just goes to show what having the museum or having a museum dedicated to the Coast Guard could mean for all of us that were involved, and to be able to pay that forward to our families and stuff. So it's just a very good example.
It's going to be awesome when it's built. I mean, I can't wait for it to get done. I always compare it to being down here in the Tidewater region, the Marine Corps Museum right outside DC. I've got no connection to the Marine Corps whatsoever, but I've taken my kids there, and my son's just fascinated by the Marines now, just because of being able to go to that museum. I can't wait to be able to take him to a Coast Guard museum. Because I mean, he loves the Coast Guard. Obviously, he's grown up in it. But to be able to see something like that, it's going to be awesome, and it's going to do a lot of good for our service, really, and keep stories like this alive, make them real for people.
Although I like it at OCS, and at OCS, every time they walk in front of the memorial, they turn, they salute it, and they have a moment of silence, and I think that's great. But I also would think like a memorial at the Coast Guard Museum, or the trouble is with the one in OCS is that it's really not open to the public. There's no sign on the highway saying Coast Guard Memorial, and there really can't be, because that's a full-fledged training base. But if they could somehow if they moved it to the museum, I don't know what the museum theme is or anything like that, but
so Peter, we know the right people, we know the right people to talk to. And I think, you got to remember there's a public private partnership, right? So anything that you want these days is built on money, right? I mean, that's the reality of the situation. Things don't just magically construct themselves, right? But we can put you in touch with the person that would either know if there's a Cuyahoga Memorial, and I'm going to get an answer for you, or kind of guide the way that we could do some fundraising to get one built.
Right. That would be great.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah. Even a video, something. I just went to the African American Museum in Washington and was really impressed with what they did and way modern museums look. And I'm very excited about it. It's going to be in New London, right?
It is. Yep.
Yes.
That's great.
Definitely drivable
I'll
for
be
you.
Sure to, I'll be sure to write to the legislators and tell them to put up their share.
Perfect. Excellent.
Connecticut.
Excellent. Well, Peter, we so much appreciate your time today. We appreciate you you doing this for us, again, and kind of closing it out. And thank you to your wife and your daughter for reading what they did. And just for your story and for paying it forward and for the story that you wrote down in the book and the one that you recorded here. Thank you very much.
Thank you guys. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. It was powerful stuff. It really was.
Thanks.
Thanks for your service, Take Peter. Care. Yep. Stay safe. Stay healthy.
I will. Thank you.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, they had to go out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.